AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
It's never too early for Lowe's Black Friday deals. Snag some of our biggest savings of the season right now, like 25% off select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees. And get yourself free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit before the Black Friday rush. Because everyone loves free stuff, right? Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 12/3, while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
You know, it's incredibly easy to just hop into a car, turn the key, or, let's be honest, push the button these days and just, well, go. We take it for granted, don't we?
We really do.
We rarely stop to think about the almost unimaginable complexity involved in building that vehicle. I mean, a modern car, a truck. It can have tens of thousands of individual parts. Thousands.
Yeah. It's mind-boggling when you actually stop and consider it.
And every single one of those parts, from the engine block down to the smallest, seemingly insignificant washer or clip, has to meet these incredibly precise standards.
Absolutely. And, you know, that level of complexity means that the quality, the safety, the reliability you experience when you drive isn't just something magic that happens on the final assembly line.
Mm-hmm.
It originates much, much earlier.
Right.
It's baked in deep within the supply chain with hundreds, maybe even thousands of companies providing components and services. And if just one critical part isn't manufactured correctly, if it doesn't meet spec, the entire system can be jeopardized. It could impact performance, safety, durability.
Yeah, the knock-on effects could be huge.
Exactly.
And that's precisely why today we're pulling back the curtain a bit. We're taking a deep dive into the hyper-specific details of how one of the world's absolute automotive giants, Ford Motor Company, attempts to manage that mind-boggling complexity.
Mm-hmm.
We are peeling back the layers on the detailed, almost granular requirements they place on the organizations, the suppliers that provide them with those critical parts.
And our compass for this particular deep dive is a document that's, well, critically important, yet rarely seen outside the world of automotive suppliers and quality professionals.
Yeah.
The Ford customer-specific requirements for IATF 16949.201 STEEN. This is the edition effective June 2025.
Okay.
Now, yes, if you just look at the title, it sounds like a dense technical manual.
Yeah.
And it is technical, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
But within these pages, 45 of them, to be exact, are the absolute rules of engagement for doing business with Ford. It's the master document that explains exactly how Ford takes a widely accepted global automotive quality standard, IATF 16949, and layers on their own unique needs, processes, and expectations.
So it's their specific flavor on top of the standard.
Precisely. It's how they ensure quality, reliability, and safety throughout their entire fast supply network.
Think of this document as, well, maybe not a secret handshake because it's published, but certainly a very detailed instruction manual and contract that you must understand inside and out if you want to successfully navigate the Ford supply ecosystem.
That's a good way to put it.
Our mission today, just for you, is to serve as your expert guides. We're going to dig into this document, pull out the most important, interesting, and frankly, sometimes surprising nuggets of information, cut through the industry jargon, and translate it into plain English.
Yeah, cut through the noise.
This is your shortcut to truly understanding a crucial piece of the automotive quality puzzle, what it really takes to be a Ford supplier, and how these incredibly detailed requirements ripple throughout the entire industry, ultimately affecting the cars we all drive.
All right, let's open up this document and begin at the beginning, the foundational requirements, section one.
So why do these customer-specific requirements even exist? I mean, IATF 16949 is a globally recognized standard for automotive quality management systems. Isn't achieving that certification enough on its own? Seems like it should be.
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and it gets right to the heart of why documents like this are necessary. IATF 16949 is absolutely foundational, no question.
Okay.
It provides a robust, internationally recognized baseline for quality management systems tailored to the unique demands of the automotive sector. It covers everything from leadership commitment and risk-based planning to operational control and continuous improvement. It's essential. But, and this is where the customer-specific part comes in. major automakers, original equipment manufacturers, or OEMs like Ford, they have their own legacy processes, unique engineering specifications, specific product designs, particular manufacturing approaches, and lists of items they deem especially critical. These needs often go beyond the general framework provided by IATF 16949.
Okay. So the Ford document isn't replacing the standard. It's building on it, customizing it for their world.
Precisely. That's exactly it. These customer-specific requirements act as an additional layer, tailoring the general IATF 16949 framework to Ford's specific way of designing, manufacturing, and managing its supply chain. They bridge that gap, addressing Ford's particular needs, history, proprietary systems, and unique engineering demands.
Gotcha. Who exactly needs to comply with these requirements? Is it just the big Tier 1 suppliers shipping directly to Ford assembly plants, or does it go deeper?
The scope is quite broad, which is important to understand. The document states it applies to organizations where automotive customer-specified parts for production and/or service are manufactured. This means any organization supplying parts to Ford Motor Company, Lincoln Motor Company, or any joint ventures Ford is involved with for either original equipment production or service part applications.
So pretty much anyone making a Ford-specified part.
Yeah. The goal, as stated, is to define fundamental quality system requirements for these suppliers. Simple as that.
And it's not just about having a quality system that meets these requirements. There's a very explicit mandate for third-party certification, isn't there?
That's absolutely a non-negotiable requirement for the vast majority of suppliers. Organizations supplying production and/or service parts must be third-party certified to IATF 16949.
Right.
But, and this is where the Ford document adds its specific layer, the certification scope, as verified by the third-party auditor, must include both the IATF 16949 standard and these accompanying Ford customer-specific requirements.
Oh.
You can't be certified to just the standard alone for Ford. You have to be certified to the standard plus the Ford specifics. They have to check both boxes.
So the auditors aren't just checking IATF boxes. They're checking the Ford boxes, too. That makes the audit quite specific.
Exactly. And the document adds another layer of credibility by requiring that the certifying bodies themselves must be currently contracted and recognized by an IATF oversight office and conduct the certification in compliance with the IATF recognized automotive certification scheme.
Okay, so the auditors themselves are audited in a way.
You could say that. It ensures that the audits are consistent, rigorous, and internationally recognized by the official body overseeing the IATF standard. It maintains the integrity of the whole system.
I noticed the document specifies that the English version is the official one for registration purposes, even for global suppliers. That seems like maybe a small administrative detail, but for a global supply chain, it highlights the need for absolute precision, doesn't it?
It is a small detail with potentially significant implications. You're right. For the official certification process, for legal interpretation, and for audit purposes, the English version of these requirements is the definitive one.
Right.
While suppliers in other countries might use sanctioned translations for internal reference, any disputes or formal requirements during an audit will default back to the English text. It's really about eliminating potential ambiguities across different languages when it comes to the critical requirements being audited. You need one definitive source.
Makes sense. Let's talk about something else that's a well-known benchmark in the automotive world, particularly with Ford, Q1 status. How do these specific requirements tie into achieving Q1?
Q1, yes. This document is the direct link. It explicitly states that third-party registration to ITF 16949, including demonstrated compliance with these Ford customer-specific requirements, is the primary mechanism by which production and service part organizations supplying Ford achieve that coveted Q1 status.
So certification isn't just a hoop to jump through. It's the fundamental gateway to being recognized by Ford as a preferred high-performing supplier, the key to the kingdom, so to speak.
Precisely. Yeah. That's it, exactly. Q1 status signifies that a supplier has met Ford's stringent quality and performance benchmarks, and registration to the standard plus the customer specifics is the formal validation of your quality management system meeting those foundational requirements.
Okay.
And beyond just getting certified, organizations are required to record evidence of their certification status, including the scope covering the Ford specifics, in Ford's global supplier database, which is known as GSDB Online.
And maintaining that status in GSDB seems important. It's not a one-and-done thing.
Crucially important, yes. The document mandates that organizations must proactively notify Ford of any change in their IATF-16949 registration status by updating their information in GSDB online.
Any change?
Any change. This isn't just for initial certification. It includes successful recertification, transferring their certification to a different body, or any negative change, like certificate withdrawal, cancellation, or suspension. Ford relies on GSDB to have an accurate, real-time picture of their supply base's certification compliance.
That makes sense. They need to know who's currently meeting the standard. Are there any exceptions to this mandatory certification? It sounds pretty strict.
It is strict, but there is a very narrow path for exceptions. The document mentions that Ford may, strictly at its option, waive the IATF-16949 certification requirement for certain organizations.
Okay, how does that work?
Well, this is not something a supplier applies for.
Yeah.
It's typically initiated and managed internally by Ford based on their assessment. The criteria for such a waiver are strict and usually involve an organization's proven track record and the state of their existing quality management system.
Right.
Even with a waiver, the organization is typically required to maintain a specific minimum performance level, explicitly noted as scoring no less than 80 points in Ford's supplier improvement metrics, SIM, and meeting Q1 manufacturing site assessment, Q1 MSA requirements.
So even without the third-party certificate, they're still under intense performance scrutiny by Ford. There's no free pass.
Absolutely. The waiver is based on Ford's confidence in their internal system and demonstrated performance, and that performance continues to be monitored rigorously. The waiver is not a reduction in quality expectation, just a different method of verification driven by Ford's judgment.
Right. Okay, so thinking about this foundational section, what's the big takeaway for someone trying to understand this world? What should you remember?
Well, what's fascinating here is the clear, deliberate layering. Ford isn't just adopting a global standard. They are building upon it with requirements that are absolutely critical to their products, their processes, and their supply chain integrity.
Mm-hmm.
These layers of standards, customer specifics, mandatory third-party audits, and the direct link to achieving valued Q1 status aren't just bureaucratic hurdles. For you, the listener, it's the foundational bedrock of trust and reliability in an industry where failure can have severe consequences. These processes are the mechanisms designed to ensure that the quality, reliability, and safety you expect in a Ford vehicle begin with each component, long before it reaches the assembly plant. Certification is the formal validation that this foundational trust is earned.
It really highlights the complexity and the need for every part of the system to be solid, doesn't it, from the ground up?
Precisely. Now, before we dive deeper into the operational requirements, it's critical to understand that just like any major company or industry, Ford has its own specific language. And in this document, understanding that lexicon is absolutely key.
Ah, the language barrier, even within the same industry. Why is understanding Ford's specific terminology in this document so crucial? Seems like jargon sometimes.
It can feel like jargon, but this is paramount because the document contains a very clear rule. Where inconsistent terminology exists between IATF 16949 and this document shall take precedence.
Okay, Ford's definitions rule.
Yes. This means if Ford uses a term in a slightly different way than the standard, or define something specifically, you must use Ford's definition to correctly interpret and comply with the requirements listed in this document. You can't default to the IATF definition if there's a conflict. Ford's definition is king here.
That makes sense. It's like learning the dialect of the specific customer. Let's unpack some of these essential terms then. Active part sounds simple enough, but the definition looks quite specific.
It is. An active part is defined as a part currently supplied for original equipment production, or for service applications. But the important detail, as you hinted, is when it stops being active. It's not just when the vehicle model stops production.
Right.
A part remains defined as active by Ford until tooling scrap authorization is given by the appropriate customer activity. And notably, for parts produced without Ford-owned tooling, or where a tool is shared across multiple part numbers, deactivation requires specific written confirmation from both Ford engineering and the Ford buyer.
Wow, that's a very deliberate process. It shows Ford maintains control and knowledge of the part's status long after it's rolling off the main assembly line, presumably for service and replacement needs. They tracked it for a long time.
Exactly. It reflects a long-term lifecycle management perspective. And the note about bulk material is important. The definition applies to the contracted bulk material itself, like a coil of steel or a drum of adhesive, not the individual parts that might be formed or used from it.
Okay. Next up, aftermarket parts. This seems like a critical quality distinction.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
Aftermarket parts are defined in the document as replacement parts not procured or released by Ford Motor Company for service part applications that may not be produced to original equipment specifications.
That last part.
Yeah, that last part may not be produced to original equipment specifications is key. This definition immediately distinguishes them from genuine Ford service parts and flags them as potentially different in terms of material, process, or performance compared to the parts installed on the vehicle when it was new. Buyer beware, essentially.
That's a significant point for both quality and safety if you're, say, replacing a critical steering component or something. You want the real deal.
Precisely. Now let's tackle some terms related to production volume and capacity.
Yeah.
The document uses several acronyms here. APPC, APW, MPPC, MPW, MPPC.
Okay, a flurry of letters. Let's break those down. What do they all mean?
They all relate to the supplier's commitment to meet Ford's volume demands. APW is the average production weekly, calculated based on a 5-day work week.
Okay, average 5-day.
APW is the maximum of production weekly, calculated based on a 6-day work week, representing the highest sustainable volume the supplier can produce with their existing tooling and facilities, kind of like their surge capacity.
Right, the max they can push out.
Then APPC, or average purchase part capacity, and MPPC, maximum purchase part capacity, are the supplier's commitment in actual part count per week to meet the APW and MPW requirements, respectively. These commitments are documented in Ford's internal systems like GCP or MCPV.
So that's the number they actually sign up for.
Exactly. And PPC is the overarching term covering both APPC and MPPC, purchase part capacity.
So it's not just about being capable of making one perfect part. You have to formally commit and demonstrate you can make the required volume of quality parts week after week consistently.
Exactly. Production volume and capacity are just as critical as quality in the automotive world. And the document specifically mentions capacity verification as a required element of the phase PPP process. The production part approval process, specifically to demonstrate the supplier can meet these capacity commitments.
Okay.
It underscores Ford's focus on supply chain robustness and capability to support fluctuating production schedules. They need to know you can deliver the numbers.
Let's move to FME's failure mode and effects analysis. Big topic. The document distinguishes between families of FMEs and foundation FMEs. What's the difference and why is this distinction important?
Okay, yeah, FMEs are huge. So families of FMEs and the related families of control plans are used when you have multiple parts that are very similar in design and manufacturing process. Think of something like a left-hand and right-hand mirror assembly, or slightly different variations of the same basic bracket.
Okay, like mirror images or minor tweaks.
Right. For these, you might develop one FMEA and control plan covering the family of parts, with specific notes for the minor variations. This requires concurrence from Ford's STA, supplier technical assistance, and product development teams. It's really about efficiency for highly similar items.
Got it. Grouping similar parts makes sense. What about foundation FMEAs? That sounds different, more fundamental.
This is where it gets really interesting and shows a more mature approach to knowledge management. Foundation FMEAs, sometimes called corporate generic, baseline core, or master FMEAs, are different. They are not tied to a specific part number. Instead, they are built around a particular process type, like injection molding, welding, painting, or stamping. They capture the accumulated knowledge, best practices, potential failure modes, causes, effects, and controls known for that type of process, drawing heavily from past developments, lessons learned from problem-solving activities like 8D, Six Sigma, or Shane methodologies, and historical data.
Ah, so they're a way of institutionalizing knowledge and preventing past problems from recurring in new projects, capturing lessons learned.
Precisely.
Right.
That's the core idea. They act as a central repository of knowledge for a given manufacturing process. A part-specific FMEA would then start by referencing and building upon the relevant foundation FMEA for the processes used to make that part. The document emphasizes that foundation FMEAs are living documents and must be updated with knowledge gained from new problem-solving activities. They are explicitly a starting point, not a replacement for the part-specific FMEA, but they inform it significantly, ensuring that known process risks and effective controls are considered upfront. This reveals Ford's deep emphasis on capturing lessons learned and driving prevention through structured knowledge.
That's a really proactive way to leverage past experience rather than reinventing the wheel or repeating mistakes. What about GPDS?
GPDS stands for Global Product Development System. The document defines it as Ford's standardized worldwide process for creating new products, from initial concept through to launch.
Okay, their product lifecycle process.
Exactly. Mentioning that awareness training is available for suppliers indicates that it's a defined lifecycle and a framework that suppliers need to understand and align their activities with, particularly their APQP efforts.
And STA, we mentioned them a second ago.
STA is Supplier Technical Assistance. This is Ford's dedicated team of experts who work directly with suppliers, providing technical guidance and support, particularly focused on manufacturing process development and problem solving. Their role highlights Ford's active engagement with its supply base to ensure capabilities meet expectations. They're the boots on the ground helping suppliers.
Right. The term sub-tier supplier gets a specific clarification here, too. Seems obvious, but they spell it out.
Yes. Mainly to avoid confusion with IATF 16949 terminology, which sometimes uses supplier to refer to what Ford explicitly calls a sub-tier supplier. Ford's usage aligns with common industry practice. A sub-tier supplier is any organization that provides materials, components, or services, like heat treatment or painting, to the direct Ford supplier, the Tier 1. The clarification reinforces that the quality requirements, as we'll see later, cascade down the supply chain. It matters who's who in the chain.
And finally, the 8D process, a classic.
Yes, 8D. The document defines it as a disciplined process that addresses problem solving in a methodical and analytical method, addressing root causes to eliminate the sources of the concern. It's an industry standard, 8-step approach to problem solving. Ford explicitly mandates this as the expected methodology for suppliers to use when investigating and resolving quality issues. It's their go-to problem-solving tool.
So, taking a step back and looking at all these specific terms Ford defines and uses, what does the section tell us about their overall approach to managing quality? It's a lot of specific language.
Well, these are just words on a page. They're the specific building blocks of Ford's quality language and operational philosophy. Understanding them is fundamental to correctly interpreting and applying the requirements. Terms like foundation FMEAs, the specific capacity metrics, the detailed definition of an active part, and the mandated AD process show that Ford has developed a very precise, systematic way of managing knowledge, capacity, product life cycles, and problem solving. It reveals a rigorous system designed to ensure clarity, consistency, and detailed control throughout the supply chain. Precision matters.
It really emphasizes that precision and shared understanding are absolutely key. You have to speak Ford's language.
Absolutely. Now, let's move from the language to the action. How these foundational concepts and definitions translate into concrete operational requirements for suppliers, getting into the heart of the quality system. Section 8.
Okay, let's dive into the operational requirements, starting with Section 8.1, Operational Planning and Control. The document mentions the Statement of Work, or SOW. What's the deal there?
Yes, the Statement of Work is a critical document. There can be different types, an engineering SOW, an assembly SOW, a manufacturing SOW, depending on what the supplier is providing and involved in.
Mm-hmm.
The core requirement here is that organizations must meet the requirements specified in their applicable SOW. And importantly, they must ensure their planning and execution align with GPDS timing, Ford's Global Product Development System timing and milestones.
So connecting their work back to the bigger Ford product plan?
Exactly. It ties the supplier's detailed operational planning directly into Ford's overall vehicle or product development lifecycle. You have to hit your marks on their schedule.
And APQP, Advanced Product Quality Planning, comes up here. Specifically, the External Supplier APQPP Readiness Assessment, Schedule A. That sounds formal.
It is formal. This is how Ford formally monitors and confirms a supplier's progress through the APQP process and their readiness for the production part approval process.
We PP paint.
Your Schedule A is required for specified programs and for any new tooled end items and TEIs for a launch, essentially any brand new part requiring new tooling. Its purpose is to provide a structured assessment of the supplier's APQP readiness. A key administrative but vital detail is the record retention. The final completed Schedule A, showing the assessment outcome, must be retained for the life of the part covering both production and service life, plus one additional year.
Wow, life of part plus 1 year. That's a long time.
It's a permanent record documenting the initial planning and readiness. And the requirement applies to both priority and non-priority suppliers.
So Ford isn't just saying do APQP. They have a formal process to check your planning and documentation readiness before you even get to the approval stage, a gate check.
Exactly. It's a gate to ensure sufficient planning rigor has occurred. Now, what about prototypes, making the first few parts for testing? Does the document cover that?
Prototypes are mentioned with specific requirements. Yes.
For prototype fabrication, the expectation is clear. Organizations must use the data generated during prototype builds to inform and plan for the subsequent production process. You learn from the prototype. You have to record detailed dimensional data according to the prototype build control plan, a temporary control plan, just for the prototype phase. This data is then reviewed with the Ford product development engineer responsible for the part, and you need to obtain their approval, signifying their acceptance of the prototype parts based on the data. All this is documented using the APQPPP evidence workbook.
Okay. And what if a prototype isn't quite perfect? Maybe it has a dimension slightly out of spec. Does that kill the project?
Not necessarily. Ford understands that prototypes are part of the development journey. They're not always perfect first time. Ford PD Engineering can approve the use of non-compliant prototype parts for evaluation or testing purposes, but it's not a casual sign-off.
Right.
It requires a formal process documented via a WERS alert, the Worldwide Engineering Release System alert. This creates a formal record of the deviation and its approved use, ensuring traceability even for non-conforming prototypes. Everything gets documented.
It seems like everything is tracked, even temporary deviations. What about the tooling used to make those prototypes? Even disposing of that is controlled. Seems like overkill, maybe.
That's right. It might seem like it, but you might think once the prototype phase is over, you can just scrap the tooling. But the document specifies a formal process involving Ford's Global Asset Management, GM, and requires approval from Ford PD Engineering before prototype tooling disposal authorization is given.
Huh. Why?
It highlights how strictly Ford manages assets and maintains control over even temporary tooling associated with their parts. They own it. They control his fate.
Interesting. Okay, moving on to section 8.2, requirements for products and services. How do suppliers communicate changes they initiate after a part is approved? Say they find a better way to make it.
That's handled through the SREA process supplier request for engineering approval. This is the formal gateway required for organizations to propose and gain approval for process changes they want to make after the initial part approval.
PPP.
Okay, SREA for process changes. Yes. It's distinct from design changes, which typically go through Ford's WERS system. SREA ensures that any proposed changes to the manufacturing process by the supplier are formally reviewed and approved by the relevant Ford engineering and quality teams before they are implemented on production parts. There's also a specific SREA process outlined for changes affecting service unique parts.
Got it. Formal process for any tweaking after approval. Now, let's talk about one of the most critical areas, special characteristics. Section 8.2.3.1.2 and later sections mention these, and they seem central to Ford's quality strategy.
We are absolutely central, yeah.
Yeah.
Special characteristics are features of a product or parameters of a manufacturing process that have been identified by Ford as requiring specific controls because they significantly impact fit, function, performance, durability, or, most importantly, safety and compliance with regulations.
Really important stuff.
Exactly. Ford uses specific symbols to designate these, although they do allow suppliers to use their own internal symbols as long as there's a clear correlation back to the Ford requirements.
Okay. What are the main Ford symbols or designations we need to know?
The most critical designation is the critical characteristic, identified by the inverted delta symbol. Looks like a triangle pointing down.
The inverted delta. Got it.
These are characteristics with a direct safety or legal consideration. Ford Engineering identifies these during the design phase, and they are concurred by Ford Manufacturing. You'll see the ASA symbol marked clearly on the relevant Ford drawings and specifications. The document also explicitly states that fasteners starting with the W9 part number prefix are to be treated as inverted delta parts, meaning they also have critical characteristics associated with them.
Okay, so inverted delta means safety or legal. Big deal. And the other types, the outline mentioned SC, HI, and OS. Are they in this document?
Yes. The Ford FMEA handbook, which is referenced in this document, defines others like significant characteristic, SC, high impact HI, and operator safety, OS. A significant characteristic, SE, is typically related to the part's fit, function, or performance, but not safety or legal compliance.
Still important, but not safety.
Right. A high-impact HI characteristic is one whose variation significantly impacts downstream manufacturing processes or assembly. An operator's safety OS characteristic relates to potential hazards to the operator during manufacturing. While these are important, the document puts the most stringent requirements and traceability mandates on the critical characteristics because of their safety and legal implications. The table in this document specifically calls out the U symbol for CCs. That's the one with the heavy focus here.
Okay, so the inverted delta is the big one, tied directly to safety and legal compliance. And the document puts a huge emphasis on traceability for these critical characteristics, right?
Absolutely paramount.
Right.
For any characteristic designated as a critical characteristic, the requirement is explicit and demanding. It must be traceable forward through the entire quality planning chain, like a golden thread.
The whole chain? What does that entail?
It means traceable from the DFMEA. Design FMEA, where the potential failure mode and its associated characteristic are first identified, through the PFMEA, process FMEA, where the manufacturing risks are assessed, to the SECAF, Special Characteristics Communication and Agreement Form, where agreement on control methods is documented, to the control plan, which defines the ongoing process controls, and finally, recorded with supporting evidence in the APQPP PAPE evidence workbook.
Wow.
And this applies even to built-to-print organizations that receive DFMEA information from Ford. They still have to implement the traceability through their PFMEA control plan and workbook. No escaping it.
That's a really comprehensive chain of documentation. It ensures that the criticality of that characteristic is never lost sight of, from initial design intent all the way through production.
Exactly. It ensures that everyone involved understands its importance and how it's being controlled. And there's a crucial requirement for controls on critical characteristics, regardless of where in the supply chain they're actually manufactured.
Regardless of where, even at sub-tiers.
Yes. The document states that organizations must document special controls in the APQPP-PPO evidence workbook, specifically designed to prevent shipment of non-conforming critical characteristics. This applies whether that characteristic is created at the Tier 1 supplier's plant or a Tier 2 or Q3 sub-tier supplier location. Ford is pushing the responsibility and the need for preventative controls for these critical items all the way down the chain.
That's a very high level of expectation, pushing control down that far. It sounds like you can't just hope it's right. You need specific controls to ensure it's right wherever it's made.
Precisely. It moves from detection towards prevention, especially for safety critical items. Now let's touch on manufacturing feasibility, section 8.2.1.3. What's that about? This is a requirement for documented manufacturing feasibility reviews. These are mandatory whenever there are new processes, updated processes, or capacity increases involving new or modified tooling or equipment. The review must use a specific Ford form and adhere to timing defined in APQP. Crucially, it requires participation from all appropriate organization and Ford organizations, meaning personnel from the supplier's design, manufacturing, quality, and purchasing teams, as well as relevant Ford engineering, manufacturing, and SDA personnel should be involved.
So everyone gets in a room, virtually or physically, to make sure it's actually doable.
Pretty much. It's a formal review to confirm that the supplier can actually produce the part, according to Ford's specifications, at the required volume using their planned process. Can you really make this thing the way you say you can?
Look, your crucial reality check before you commit to production, making sure it's actually possible and sustainable.
It absolutely is.
Ah.
Now let's transition to design and development, section 8.3, specifically revisiting FMEAs and control plans in more detail. There's more on them here.
Okay, section 8.3.2.1 reinforces the FMEA requirement again.
Yes, it reiterates that both process FMEAs, BFMEAs, and design FMEAs, DFMEAs for design responsible suppliers, as well as control plans, must be aligned with critical to quality process requirements that are identified in Ford's supplier manufacturing health charts. They all need to talk to each other.
And there are specific acceptance requirements from Ford for these documents. It's not just submit and forget.
No, definitely not. Particularly for those critical characteristics. PFMEAs and control plans for S parts require formal acceptance, not just review, but documented acceptance from both Ford Engineering and Ford STA.
Both. Engineering and STA?
Both. And for design responsible organizations, their DFMEAs also require formal acceptance from Ford Engineering. This acceptance is required not only for the initial versions, but also for any significant revisions. Ford also reserves the right, at their discretion to require acceptance for FMEAs and control plans for any part, not just S parts, if they feel it's necessary.
So, for these critical items, Ford experts are actively reviewing and signing off on the supplier's planned approach to managing risk and controlling the process. That's a significant level of oversight.
Correct. It's a formal concurrence process, ensuring Ford's expertise is leveraged in the supplier's planning for the most critical aspects. The document notes that Ford accepts FMEAs done using either the format in the Ford FMEA handbook or the globally recognized AIAG and VDA FMEA format, with an exception for bulk materials, still referencing the older AIAG PPAP 4th edition manual.
And those foundation FMEAs we discussed earlier, this section adds more detail about them being living documents. What does that mean in practice?
Yes, it strongly reinforces that foundation FMEAs are required for each process type and are explicitly living documents. The requirement is that knowledge gained from problem-solving activities, like 8D investigations, must be documented and incorporated into both the part-specific FMEA and the relevant foundation FMEA.
Both.
This isn't optional. It's a core part of their continuous improvement and knowledge retention strategy. Problem-solving isn't just about fixing the current issue. It's about updating the knowledge base to prevent recurrence across similar processes in the future.
Makes sense. Feed the lessons learned back into the system, and using specific FMEA software is required now.
Yes, the document states, suppliers shall use FMEA software, which ensures the alignment of the foundation FAA, part FEA, control plan, and other applicable documents. This drives suppliers towards integrated digital tools that automatically link these documents and enforce data flow, making traceability and updates much more robust and less prone to error.
Okay. Here's a fascinating one that caught my eye. Reverse FMEA. What exactly is that and why is it a requirement? Sounds backwards.
The reverse FEA process, RFMEA, is a really practical, hands-on, and yeah, somewhat counterintuitive quality verification method. It's explicitly required for new launches.
No launches only.
Okay. Right. The process involves Ford and supplier design process engineers, quality personnel, and crucially, plant floor operators working together. They actively try to simulate failure modes on actual production equipment or a replicated setup. The goal is to deliberately introduce defects, try to bypass or defeat existing error-proofing mechanisms like Boki Yokes, and identify any potential failure modes, their causes, or gaps in control plans that were not identified during the theoretical desk-based FMEA analysis.
Whoa. So instead of just analyzing potential failures on paper, they're actively trying to make the process fail in a controlled environment? Trying to break it.
Exactly. It's a way to test the robustness of the process and the control plan in a real-world setting, leveraging the practical knowledge of the operators who work with it every day. It's first done at the equipment builder's site before shipment, and then repeated on the supplier's plant floor after the equipment is installed.
Okay.
Evidence of these RFMEA events, including findings and resulting actions, must be documented and available. It's a powerful illustration of Ford pushing suppliers beyond theoretical compliance to practical validation. Let's see if we can really make it fail.
That's a great example of proactive risk identification. Plan it, document it, review it, and then actively try to break it to find the hidden issues before they find you.
Precisely. And all this FMEA and control plan documentation must be provided to Ford upon request. They want to see it.
Control plans are mentioned again, with a specific focus on pre-launch control plans. What are those about?
Yes. The requirement is reiterated that all Ford parts must have control plans, which define the methods for controlling process inputs and outputs, with specific note that dynamic control plans are sometimes required by powertrain. The concept of pre-launch control plans, sometimes called safe launch control plans, is critical during new product introductions or significant process changes.
Okay. What makes a pre-launch control plan different from a regular one?
These plans are required for parts produced from the earliest production intent stages, from off-tool, off-process, OTKP, or initial trial builds, until the part receives final approval for regular production, OK to buy, or OKTB. They mandate extraordinary controls beyond what would typically be included in the standard production control plan.
Extraordinary controls?
Oh, yeah.
What does that usually involve? Like, what kind of things?
It often involves things like 100% inspection of certain characteristics, increased frequency of testing, enhanced documentation, maybe additional checks by operators or auditors, or specific error-proofing methods applied temporarily.
Mm-hmm.
The goal is to ensure that any issues arising during the early production ramp-up are identified and contained immediately before a non-conforming product can reach Ford's plants. There are specific exit criteria that the supplier must meet to transition from the pre-launch to the standard production control plan, especially for priority suppliers.
Exit criteria.
This often includes achieving a minimum period, typically 4 weeks, of clean production without quality claims, a formal data review with Ford SDA, and verification that any permanent corrective actions for launch issues have been implemented effectively. If issues occur during the safe launch period, the duration of these extraordinary controls is extended. You don't get off easy if things go wrong, and data from all phases of the launch must be available for review by Ford.
That sounds like an intense period of scrutiny and control to ensure a smooth, high-quality launch. Very hands-on.
It absolutely is. Now, the document gets very specific about material analysis requirements for control item fasteners, down to the nitty-gritty on bolts and screws. This highlights how certain critical components receive specific, detailed requirements.
Yeah.
For heat-treated manifesters, the requirement is rigorous. Samples from every coil or bundle of incoming raw material must be analyzed for chemical composition and quenched hardness before that material is released for use.
Every single coil.
Additional samples from each coil are also tested for chemical or quenched hardness depending on the process. For non-heat-treated fasteners, there's a visual check against mill documents and testing of hardness and other physical properties for each coil or bundle. This level of detail for fasteners underscores their critical nature in vehicle assembly and safety. You don't want bolts failing.
No kidding. Again, intense focus on prevention and verification for critical items.
And related to traceability, the document simply states that the organization shall maintain lot traceability for all Ford parts. This means having systems in place to identify specific production lots of parts, which is crucial for recalls or investigating field issues.
Standard practice, but essential.
What about design verification, DV? Is that covered?
Yes. Design verification, DV, is required to demonstrate that the part conforms to Ford's engineering requirements, as specified in documents like the Attribute Requirements List, ARL, and the System Design Specification, SDS. Basically, prove it meets the spec.
The results of DV testing must be formally recorded and submitted to Ford Product Engineering for approval. For organizations responsible for conducting component-level DV testing, a documented design verification plan or report, DVPNR, is needed. This DVPNR must include details of tests conducted by the supplier, any sub-tier suppliers, and where applicable, Ford's own tests. This requirement applies regardless of the PPPay submission level or whether the supplier has design responsibility or is build to print.
So whether you designed it or just built it to their print, you have to formally show it meets their performance specs through testing.
Correct. And demonstrating that verification is a key part of the approval process. And the document also integrates GPDS milestone reviews here. Yes, for critical characteristics, parts, design-responsible organizations must include representatives from Ford Engineering, Assembly, and Manufacturing in relevant GPDS milestone design reviews. They are also encouraged to do this for all parts where it's feasible. It's about ensuring cross-functional input from Ford throughout the supplier's design and development process, especially for critical items. Get everyone looking at it.
Collaboration is built right in. Finally, the Product Approval Process, PPP, Section 8.3.4.4, the big sign-off.
Right. Compliance with the AIAG PPP manual and Ford's global phase PPP requirements is mandatory for all production parts. For service parts, the AIAG service PPP manual is also required. The default process for submitting PBX documentation is through Ford's electronic PSW-EPSW system, though the document lists specific exceptions for things like SREAs, parts from directed Tier 2 suppliers, capacity uplifts, and bulk material.
Okay, EPSW is the norm. What about sub-tier supplier PPAP? Does Ford need to see every single sub-tier PPAP package? That would be mountains of paperwork.
No, thankfully. The document clarifies that for sub-tier component approvals, a summary is generally sufficient for the submission to Ford, for example. A list of approved PSWs from the Tier 1 sub-tiers documented in the APK PPAP evidence workbook.
Okay.
The primary responsibility for reviewing and approving sub-tier PPAP remains with the direct Ford supplier, the Tier 1.
Makes sense. If a supplier initiates a change to an already approved part or process, how does that integrate with the PPAP process? They need approval again, right?
This is crucial, yes. Organization-initiated design changes typically go through Ford's WERS system first, unless the supplier doesn't have WERS access. For organization-initiated process changes, like moving to a new machine or a different manufacturing method, the supplier must first obtain SREA approval before implementing the change.
SREA first.
SREA first. After the SREA is approved, they must complete the necessary PPAP-E elements to validate the change and get PPAP approval and functional trial approval waiver before shipping any production quantities of the parts mode with the new process. A key point. Full PPAP approval will not be granted if the part or process is currently flagged with a worst alert indicating an ongoing issue.
Can't approve if there's an existing problem.
Right. And for changes to service unique parts, there's a specific SREA process via FCSD, Ford Customer Service Division.
Okay.
So this entire operational section reveals the immense level of detail and structured process Ford requires from its suppliers, covering everything from initial planning and prototyping through design reviews, rigorous risk analysis with FMEAs and reverse FEAs, intense pre-launch controls, and formal part and process approval via PPAP.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Concepts like foundation FMEAs, reverse FAA, the explicit requirements for critical characteristics, including traceability and special controls, and the structured transition from pre-launch to production demonstrate a deeply proactive, knowledge-driven, and risk-averse approach to ensuring quality is built into the process from the ground up.
It's clear that quality isn't just inspected at the end. It's planned, verified, and controlled at every imaginable step of the way. Painstakingly so.
And that control doesn't stop at the direct supplier's front door. It extends deep into the supply chain, which is our next area of focus, Section 8.4.
Okay, let's talk about extending that reach then. Section 8.4 covers control of externally provided processes, products, and services, essentially, how Ford's direct suppliers manage their suppliers, the sub-tiers. How far down does Ford's influence go?
This is where the requirements cascade significantly. The document makes it abundantly clear that while Ford might have relationships or even direct certain sub-tiers, the primary Ford supplier, the Tier 1, is held fully responsible for the quality and performance of their entire supply chain, regardless of tier level. The buck stops with the Tier 1.
Okay, starting with supplier selection, Section 8.4.1.2 for the Tier 1 suppliers, what's expected there?
Yes. The document states that the organization's process for selecting its own suppliers, meaning their sub-tiers, should include evaluating that potential sub-tier's supply chain management system. But the really striking and mandatory requirement here is for an annual financial assessment of their supply chain.
An annual financial assessment of their suppliers. Why is financial stability considered a quality requirement? That seems unusual.
That's a great question, but it makes perfect sense when you think about supply chain risk. A sub-tier supplier facing financial distress might cut corners on materials, delay investments in equipment or process controls, or even risk sudden closure, all of which can severely impact the quality and delivery of parts up the chain to Ford.
Ah, okay. A shaky supplier is a risky supplier.
Exactly. Ford recognizes that financial health is intertwined with supply chain reliability and quality. So they mandate their direct suppliers monitor the financial viability of their key suppliers. It's not just initial selection. It must be performed annually, typically in conjunction with the organization's internal audit programs.
That's a level of due diligence that goes way beyond typical quality audits. What about customer-directed sources or directed by suppliers, Section 8.4.1.3, where Ford tells the Tier 1 who to buy from?
Right. If Ford's contract with the organization specifies that the organization must use a particular sub-tier supplier, meaning Ford is directing the source, the document states that the organization still needs to obtain Ford approval before formally sourcing parts or services from that specific directed sub-tier.
Even if Ford picked them?
Yes. Even when Ford directs the source, they maintain a layer of oversight and require the direct supplier to formalize the relationship with Ford's concurrence. It keeps the Tier 1 involved and accountable.
Incoming control, Section 8.4.2.1, seems like standard practice checking parts that come in. But how does Ford specifically frame it in relation to sub-tiers?
The requirement is that organizations shall have incoming product quality measures. Pretty standard. But the key nuance is that they must use those measures as key indicators of sub-tier supplier product quality management. It explicitly connects the quality of incoming parts to the effectiveness of the sub-tier supplier's quality management system. Your incoming inspection data isn't just about sorting good from bad parts. It's a performance metric for the supplier who sent them. How good is their system?
Makes sense. And there are requirements related to statutory and regulatory compliance, Section 8.4.2.2, that extend to the supplier's supply chain too, global rules.
Yes, and this extends globally, which adds complexity. Suppliers must ensure compliance with applicable regulations, including international requirements for export vehicles specified by Ford. The document gives examples like specific plastic part marking standards, like E4WSS M99P9999-A1, and compliance with the European End-of-Life Vehicle, ELV Directive, which includes stringent material reporting requirements.
Right, the ELV rules.
Ford holds its direct suppliers accountable for ensuring their sub-tiers comply with these regulations. Even for vehicles sold in markets the sub-tier might not directly serve, the responsibility flows down.
Let's delve into supplier quality management system development, section 8.4.2.3. What if a sub-tier supplier isn't IATF 16949 certified? Does Ford just accept that?
This is a really significant point in the document. No, they don't necessarily just accept it. If a sub-tier supplier is not IATF 16949 certified, Ford reserves the right to require the direct Ford supplier, the Tier 1, to ensure that sub-tier complies with a specific lesser standard. The minimum automotive quality management system requirements for sub-tier suppliers, which is published by the IATF oversight organization.
Okay, a minimum baseline they can enforce.
Yes, and the Tier 1 organization needs to be able to provide evidence of the sub-tier's implementation and effectiveness in meeting these minimum requirements. Ford can basically say, your supplier isn't certified, fine, but you need to make sure they meet this minimum standard and prove it to us.
So Ford can push a requirement for a foundational quality system down to non-certified sub-tiers and hold the Tier 1 responsible for making sure it's happening.
Exactly. And even if Ford doesn't explicitly require it, the document encourages organizations to demand this minimum standard from their non-certified sub-tiers anyway, as a best practice for risk management.
Okay. And regardless of certifications or assessments, the Tier 1 is ultimately responsible for what their sub-tiers provide.
Unequivocally responsible. The document contains a very strong statement. Ford, or organization's second-party assessment or third-party certification of sub-tier suppliers, does not relieve the organization of full responsibility for the quality of supplied product from the sub-tier supplier.
Wow, okay. No passing the buck.
Nope. This applies even to Ford-directed sub-tiers, where Ford chose the supplier but didn't enter into a separate multi-party agreement with them. The responsibility for integrating, managing, and ensuring the quality from all sources in their supply chain ultimately rests with the direct Ford supplier.
That places a heavy burden on the Tier 1 to manage risks further down the chain. They really need to know their suppliers, and improvement efforts should be focused strategically.
Yes. The document suggests that an organization's supplier improvement efforts, particularly for sub-tiers, should focus on those that have the highest impact on supplier improvement metrics, SIM. It's about using performance data to prioritize where to spend limited resources on sub-tier development. Focus on the biggest problem areas.
The AIAG's CQI-19 guideline for sub-tier management is also mentioned here. Is that required?
It's encouraged. Organizations are encouraged to apply its principles for effective sub-tier management. However, Ford reserves the right to require the organization to apply the principles outlined in CQI-19 if Ford identifies specific deficiencies in how the organization manages its sub-tier suppliers. So, encouraged, but can become mandatory if needed.
Okay, let's circle back to critical characteristic controls, but specifically regarding sub-tiers. You mentioned this earlier, but it's the significant point reiterated here in the supply chain section.
Yes, and it bears repeating because it's such a powerful requirement extending down the chain. For critical characteristics, the direct Ford supplier must ensure that the necessary controls, those special controls designed to prevent shipment of non-conforming product, are in place at the sub-tier location where that characteristic is actually manufactured.
At the sub-tier site.
At the sub-tier site. These controls must be documented in the APQPP PAPEP evidence workbook. This applies even if it's a Ford-directed sub-tier without a multi-party agreement between Ford and that sub-tier.
So even if a safety-critical dimension is machined on a specialized piece of equipment at a Tier 3 supplier, many steps removed from the Tier 1, the Tier 1 is responsible for ensuring and documenting that the Tier 3 has adequate controls at their plant to prevent non-conformance for that specific characteristic. That's deep reach.
Exactly. It's a direct push for accountability and process control deep into the value stream, specifically for the most safety-critical elements. Ford wants those controls where the work is done. Now, let's look at supplier monitoring, section 8.4.2.4. Ford's own demanding expectations flow down here too, particularly regarding delivery.
Such as 100% on-time delivery, even from sub-tiers. That sounds tough to enforce down the chain.
Precisely. Mirroring Ford's expectation of its direct suppliers, the document states that organizations shall also require 100% on-time delivery from sub-tier suppliers. It pushes the relentless focus on delivery reliability down the entire chain.
Wow.
And if there's any delay or risk from a sub-tier that could impact Ford, the organization shall communicate any delay or risk to the affected Ford customer, meaning they must proactively notify Ford. No surprises.
And premium freight resulting from sub-tier issues. Who pays?
Organizations should monitor and minimize any premium freight expenses related to sub-tier suppliers for late deliveries. Essentially, the Tier 1 is expected to manage their sub-tiers well enough to avoid these costs. And just like critical characteristic controls, these demanding 100% on-time delivery and premium freight requirements also apply to Ford-directed sub-tiers without a specific multi-party agreement.
It's clear Ford is using its direct suppliers to enforce its performance expectations throughout the entire supply chain network. They're leveraging the Tier 1s.
Absolutely. The responsibility for managing that network, including its performance and reliability, sits squarely with the Tier 1. Now let's look at identification and traceability, section 8.5.2, which ties closely into logistics. Big area.
MPNL and MMOGL are key here, right? More acronyms.
Yes. Compliance with Ford's material planning and logistics. MPNL requirements, as detailed in documents like the Global Terms and Conditions, GTC, and the MPNL in-a-box resources, is mandatory. And a cornerstone requirement, explicitly stated as necessary to achieve and maintain Q1 status, is achieving and sustaining Level A on the Material Management Operation Guideline Logistics Evaluation, MOGLE.
Level A, MOGLE, that's the top tier, isn't it? It's a comprehensive standard for logistics and material flow management. What are some of the key requirements listed here that suppliers need to meet?
It's extensive. Key requirements listed include conducting and submitting an annual MMOGLE assessment between May and July, strict adherence to Ford's delivery ratings, robust part identification and tracking systems, lot traceability throughout the entire value chain, which explicitly includes subcontracted components like those with critical characteristics, maintaining reliable electronic communication systems with Ford, mandated use of Ford's DDL CMMS3 system for shipping and material management, processes for preventing damage during handling and transport, using correct and approved packaging forms, effective management of returnable dunnage, the container's parts are shipped in, and ensuring personnel involved in material handling are adequately trained. It covers the whole logistics flow.
So it's not enough to just manufacture a quality part. You have to manage its movement, identification, packaging, and documentation flawlessly through the supply chain, maintaining detailed traceability for critical items. This is really about preventing line stops at Ford plants due to logistics issues, which can be incredibly costly, right?
Yep. Exactly. MOGLE Level A is about supply chain velocity, accuracy, and visibility. It highlights that in modern automotive manufacturing, quality is inseparable from the intricate dance of logistics required to get the right parts to the right place at the right time, with full knowledge of their origin. Logistics is quality in many ways.
And finally, that inverted delta symbol again. It has specific identification requirements on labels.
Yes, for parts with critical characteristics, the inverted delta symbol must precede the Ford part number on shipping labels, following Ford's packaging guidelines and shipping ID label standards. The only exception noted is for branding, E108, where the symbol isn't required directly on the part if it interferes with branding, but the label needs it. So this entire section on supply chain management paints a very clear picture. Ford's quality system isn't a silo confined to its direct suppliers' facilities. It actively reaches deep, requiring quality management systems at sub-tiers, demanding detailed controls for critical items at any tier level, enforcing rigorous delivery expectations down the chain, and mandating advanced logistics capabilities like MOGLE Level A. It's a comprehensive strategy for managing risk and ensuring that quality and reliability are maintained throughout the complex network of suppliers that contributes to a vehicle.
It really sounds like they're trying to build a resilient, transparent, and high-performing ecosystem, not just manage individual suppliers one by one.
Precisely. That's a great way to summarize it. And now let's wrap up by looking at how all of this is measured, monitored, enforced, and continuously improved upon, the accountability piece, sections 9 and 10.
Okay, this brings us to section 9, performance evaluation, and section 10, improvement. How does Ford actually measure and monitor supplier performance against all these demanding requirements? What are the tools?
It's a highly data-driven process, as you'd expect, and Ford expects suppliers to be data-driven too. Ford reserves the right to request review of the data collected by the organization according to their control plans, whether those are pre-launch or production plans. They want to see the data. A core technical metric they focus on is process capability.
Right, process capability, specifically the PPK index you mentioned.
Yes, PPK, the performance index, is the primary metric Ford requires for reporting both launch and ongoing process capability. The document explicitly states that organizations shall maintain ongoing process capability at PPK 1.33. That's the magic number.
PPK greater than 1.33.
Okay. This is the target for a stable, capable process. The results of these capability studies must be recorded in the APK PPP evidence workbook and be available to Ford for review. The document also encourages using other indices like PP, CP, and CPK to get a fuller picture of process variation sources, emphasizing that the ultimate goal is variability reduction. Get the process tight and centered.
So meeting the specification isn't quite enough. You need to demonstrate your process is statistically capable of consistently meeting it with minimal variation. What happens if a process isn't meeting that PPK 1.33 target? Are there consequences?
Oh, yes. This is detailed in Table A in the document, which is a key requirement linking process capability and control status to required actions. It's very prescriptive. If a process is statistically in control, meaning only common cause variation is present, but has a PPK less than 1.33, the required action on the product output is 100% inspection. You have to check every part.
Every single one. And that asterisk again refers to error-proofing, right? Not just eyeballs.
Yes, the asterisk clarifies that the 100% inspection methodology would typically include error-proofing, such as a pokey yoke. And the critical outcome is that this inspection must prevent shipment of any non-conforming product to Ford. So if your process isn't reliably capable, you have to inspect every single part, ideally using error-proofing, to guarantee no bad parts get shipped.
That puts a lot of pressure on achieving and maintaining process capability. What if the process goes completely out of control? What does the table say then?
If your control chart indicates the process has gone out of control, meaning a special cause of variation is detected, the immediate action is 100% inspect all products since the last in-control sample, to identify and contain the non-conforming parts produced while the process was unstable, and simultaneously identify special cause to find and eliminate the source of the problem. It's a rapid data-triggered reaction plan. Contain first, then find the root cause.
Okay. And for critical characteristics, that statement about controls is even stronger, isn't it? It links back to process controls specifically, not just inspection.
Yes, this is a crucial reinforcement of a point made earlier, and it's worth repeating. The document reiterates with force that organizations ensure that critical characteristics have controls which prevent the shipment of non-conforming product, regardless of the location in the supply chain, tier 1 through tier N. And the powerful follow-up statement is that statistical process control on product characteristics without continuous manufacturing process controls is not appropriate or sufficient for critical characteristics.
Okay, let's unpack that last part slowly. What does continuous manufacturing process controls mean in contrast to just doing SBC on the final product characteristic? What's the difference?
It means that for critical safety or legal features, simply measuring the final dimension on a sample of finished parts using SBC methods is not enough if you don't have controls built directly into the manufacturing process itself to prevent the defect in the first place.
Okay. Prevention, not just detection later.
Exactly. A continuous manufacturing process control might be something like an automated inline sensor that checks a critical parameter on every single part as it's being made, or a poke yoke built into the tooling that physically prevents the part from being completed incorrectly, or automated process parameter monitoring and control. It's about controlling the inputs and immediate outputs of the process in real time to prevent the defect from occurring or immediately catching it, rather than just verifying the final characteristic on a sample batch downstream.
Mm-hmm.
For critical items, Ford demands prevention or immediate guaranteed detection via process control, not just monitoring final product variability after the fact.
That's a very clear mandate for embedding quality assurance right into the process flow itself, especially for critical items. You can't just inspect quality in at the end for those.
Absolutely. Now, how does Ford measure overall customer satisfaction from the supplier's perspective? How do they track the big picture? The primary mechanism is the supplier improvement metrics, or SIM. Organizations are required to monitor their performance against key metrics defined by Q1 criteria, which are available on the Ford Supplier Portal, FSP. The document recommends that organizations review their SIM status at least weekly, noting that some data streams are updated daily. This is Ford's dashboard for tracking a supplier's real-time performance on quality, delivery, warranty, and other key factors.
Okay, the SIM score. And this performance data needs to be communicated within the supplier's organization, not just kept in the quality department.
Yes, the document states the organization shall communicate customer satisfaction metrics to all employees who affect the quality of Ford Motor Company parts at least twice per year. It's about driving awareness throughout the company. Reinforcing that quality and performance impact everyone and are measured constantly makes it everyone's job.
What are the consequences for poor performance? This section gets quite serious, mentioning Q1 revocation and even IATF performance complaints. What happens if a supplier messes up badly?
It does get serious. If a supplier's performance drops significantly, Ford can notify the organization that they have been placed in special status of Q1 revoked. That's a big deal.
Huge deal.
Furthermore, based on the issues that led to that Q1 revocation, Ford can initiate a formal IATF performance complaint against the organization. This complaint follows the IATF's official process, which can ultimately lead to suspension or withdrawal of the supplier's global IATF 16949 certification.
Wow. So poor performance with one customer, Ford, can directly jeopardize a supplier's fundamental global quality certification that they need for other customers too.
Potentially, yes. Ford has that leverage and ability to file a complaint through the official IATF channels. The document does note, however, that a suspended IATF certificate alone does not automatically cause Q1 revocation. And if Q1 is revoked, reinstatement is a long road, requiring at least 6 months of acceptable organization performance after the issues have been resolved.
6 months clean performance.
At least. The certification body may remove the IATF certificate suspension before Q1 is reinstated once the organization has implemented effective corrective actions reviewed by the CV.
So you fix the problem, satisfy the auditors to get your IATF certificate back, but you still have to demonstrate 6 months of solid performance specifically to Ford to regain that preferred Q1 status. It's a clear consequence and a long penalty box.
It is. The document specifies that if an organization is not meeting customer requirements, particularly if they have red or orange status on the zero tolerance metrics in SIM, they must follow a standard approach with Ford SDA. This involves formal problem solving, like 8D, submitting updates to their Q1 manufacturing site assessment, MSA, and participating in reviews with STA. They get put under the microscope.
What are these specific zero tolerance metrics that can trigger such serious consequences and flag a supplier as red? What puts you in the danger zone?
The document lists the specific zero tolerance metrics defined by Q1 criteria that impact RDD supplier status. A Q1 score below 85 points, issues identified during the Q1 manufacturing site assessment, poor performance in program and launch support, meaning issues during new product launches, high commodity PPM, parts per million, for both production and service parts, a high QR quality-related rate over a six-month period, any stop shipments, where Ford has to stop receiving parts due to a major issue, involvement in field service actions, recalls, or service campaigns, poor delivery performance for production and service parts, and a high warranty R1000, repairs per 1,000 vehicles.
That's a comprehensive dashboard covering quality from production through warranty and service, plus delivery and launch performance. A lot of ways to get flagged. And this performance data is also shared with the IATF certifying bodies.
Yes, the document explicitly requires organizations to provide the full Q1 scoring detail and performance metrics summary page prints from the Ford supplier portal to their certification body during their IATF 16949 surveillance or recertification audits.
They have to show their report card to the auditor.
Exactly. This must include documentation of any interactions they've had with Ford regarding red or orange zero tolerance metrics.
Mm.
Furthermore, Ford reserves the right to provide periodic performance reports directly to the certification body and/or the IATF oversight office. This creates a very direct, visible link between a supplier's actual performance for a major automotive customer and their fundamental quality system certification status. Performance matters for certification.
Let's move to management review, section 9.3. What's required of supplier leadership? How involved do they need to be?
Senior management at the supplier organization shall hold monthly QOS, Quality Operating System, performance meetings, as specifically required by the Q1 MSA criteria.
Monthly meetings.
Monthly. The results and outputs from these mandatory monthly QOS reviews shall be integral to the senior management reviews required by IATF 16949. The document clarifies that the management review can be structured as a series of meetings, but the key performance data, including the Q1 MSA results, must be a mandatory input to these highest-level reviews, and they must happen at least monthly in the form of QOS meetings.
So quality performance data, especially Ford's metrics, is a mandatory frequent topic at the highest levels of supplier management. It can't be ignored.
Precisely. It ensures accountability and focus from the top down. Now let's look at internal audits, Section 9.2. There's a strong focus on manufacturing process audits, Section 9.2.2.3.
And this applies throughout the supply chain, not just the Tier 1.
Yes. Crucially, the document states that organizations and all tiers of suppliers providing product or services to Ford must be assessed against applicable Ford global manufacturing process standards and assessments.
All tiers. How do they manage that?
The results of these process assessments must be documented in a web-based tool called the Special Process Tracker. The document notes that self-assessment by sub-tiers, including documentation of corrective actions, is acceptable to fulfill this requirement. So Tier 1 needs to ensure their sub-tiers are doing these process audits and documenting them.
Okay. There's a particularly detailed requirement for heat treat assessments. This seems to be a singled out special process. Why so much focus on heat treat?
It is singled out. Heat treating is a critical process in manufacturing many metal components, and if not controlled precisely, it can lead to major issues like parts being too brittle or not strong enough, which can have severe safety consequences.
Right.
So organizations and sub-tiers providing heat-treated product or services must comply not only with AAG CQI-9 Special Process Heat Treat System Assessment Standard, but also with specific Ford requirements layered on top of CQI-9.
Okay, CQI-9 plus Ford extras. And how often are these assessments required?
The assessment is required annually for each heat-treating process at each site and at all tier levels involved in supplying Ford.
Annually, every site, every tier. That's a huge undertaking.
It is. It's also required whenever there are significant changes to the heat treat process or equipment. The status of these assessments must be entered into GSDB online, and organizations must retain the prior two annual reports. This annual multi-site, multi-tier requirement highlights how critical Ford views the control of this specific special process. Compliance with CQI-9 and the Ford specifics doesn't relieve the organization of ultimate responsibility for the heat-treated product's quality. They also reference a specific Ford material specification, WSS M99A3A, aimed at reducing the risk of hydrogen embrittlement in heat-treated steel parts.
That's incredibly thorough scrutiny on a process that, if it goes wrong, could have major safety implications. Very targeted.
Absolutely. It demonstrates a very targeted approach to controlling high-risk processes. Finally, let's look at improvement, Section 10. Specifically, nonconformity and corrective action, Section 10.2. What's the focus here?
Preventing shipment of non-conforming product comes up again. It's everywhere in this document.
Yes, it's a recurring fundamental theme. Organizations must have robust processes and systems in place to prevent shipment of non-conforming product to Ford. And when non-conforming product or process output does occur, they are mandated to use the 8D methodology for analysis.
Back to the 8D.
The 8D process is the required tool for investigating the non-conformance, finding the true root cause, implementing effective corrective actions, and verifying those actions eliminate the source of the problem and prevent recurrence. It's the standard Ford way.
There are very specific and very tight timelines for responding to customer concerns reported by Ford, aren't there? Like really fast turnarounds.
Indeed there are, reflecting the urgency when an issue impacts Ford's production or customers. The clock starts ticking the moment Ford sends the notification. You must provide an initial response within 24 hours.
24 hours.
You must implement containment actions in the Ford plant if the suspect parts are already there and provide Ford with certified clean stock. You need to deliver an initial 8D report covering steps D0, symptom, through D3, interim containment actions, very quickly. If the issue is suspected to affect shipments to Ford Customer Service Division, FCSD, you must notify Ford Service within 48 hours, and you must deliver the full 8D report or six-panel report detailing the root cause analysis and the full action plan, D4 through D6, within 15 calendar days of the initial notification.
15 calendar days for a full root cause and action plan. Those are incredibly demanding timelines for performing a thorough investigation and developing a robust plan.
They are, and they underscore the expectation for suppliers to have rapid response capabilities and effective problem-solving processes already in place, ready to go. The document mentions using tools like the QR process summary and global AD systems to manage this. You need to be geared up for it.
Handling return product test analysis is also a specific requirement, closing the loop on parts that come back.
Yes. Organizations must have a documented system for managing parts returned from Ford plants, like those identified during incoming inspection or assembly issues, and warranty parts returned from the field. The analysis results from these returned parts must be communicated to relevant Ford and supplier teams, included as key evidence in the ED report for the issue, and the summary analysis results must be included in the monthly QOS report that goes to supplier management review.
Okay.
Furthermore, Ford plant PPM, parts per million, data must be communicated to all employees on the organization's plant team.
That creates a vital closed-loop feedback system, doesn't it? Ensuring that issues found in Ford's plants or in the field are quickly fed back to the supplier's engineering, quality, and production teams, and even communicated broadly to employees on the floor, driving continuous improvement based on real-world performance.
Yeah, exactly. It closes the loop from detection at the customer or in the field back to problem-solving and prevention at the source. It makes the problems visible. And finally, the document requires compliance with various Ford documents and requirements regarding warranty management systems, section 10.2.5, including the PPGT&Cs, production part, global terms and conditions, web guides, Q1 criteria, and the manufacturing site assessment, MSA.
Okay.
So this entire section on performance evaluation and improvement is really the engine driving accountability. It details how Ford rigorously measures supplier performance through metrics like PPK, SIM, PPM, and warranty data, and how they enforce consequences through mechanisms like the Table A actions, that 100% inspection, the zero tolerance metrics triggering performance reviews and potential Q1 revocation, and the ability to file IATF performance complaints.
The incredibly rapid timelines for responding to customer concerns and the mandated AD process demonstrate the expectation for swift, effective problem solving. The specific focus on critical processes like heat treat, requiring annual multi-tier audits, and the detailed requirements for analyzing returned parts all underscore a relentless, data-driven pursuit of quality and a culture of continuous improvement in this industry.
It's a demanding, layered system designed to not just detect problems, but to prevent them, react quickly when they occur, and ensure robust, permanent corrective actions that feed back into the knowledge base. It's quite a system.
Absolutely. It's about building quality not just into the part, but into the entire supplier operation and its supply chain. It's comprehensive.
Okay, wow. We've taken a comprehensive journey through Ford's customer-specific requirements for IATF 16949. We've explored the foundational requirements for certification and Q1 status, navigated Ford's specific lexicon, all those acronyms and definitions, delved into the intense operational controls required from planning and prototyping through production and part approval, traced how these requirements cascade deep into the supply chain, and finally, understood the rigorous system of measurement, accountability, and continuous improvement.
Yeah, we've taken what appears on the surface to be a dry technical manual and hopefully distilled its essence, revealing the detailed operational blueprint that underpins quality and reliability in one of the world's largest and most complex automotive supply chains. It's far more than just rules on paper. It's a comprehensive system for managing immense risk and complexity day in, day out.
And for you, the listener, you now hopefully have a unique insight into the hidden systems, the specific demands, and the sheer rigor that ensure the tens of thousands of parts making up a Ford vehicle meet stringent safety, quality, and performance standards. You understand the intricate why behind many of the complex quality processes and logistics requirements you might encounter or hear about in high-stakes manufacturing. It's not arbitrary. There's a system behind it.
And what's truly fascinating to consider, maybe as a final thought, is how this incredibly detailed, cascaded system of requirements reaching deep into the supply chain, demanding specific methodologies like ADA and reverse FMEA, embedding controls for critical characteristics right at the source, and linking performance directly to both Q1 status and potentially global IATF certification, how all of that shapes not just the quality of a finished vehicle, but the very culture, operational DNA, and capabilities of the companies that are part of this ecosystem. You know, how does this level of top-down standardization and strict control, which is clearly necessary for safety and consistency, coexist with, or perhaps even influence, a supplier's ability to innovate and find novel ways to improve processes? It's a fundamental tension in high-reliability manufacturing, isn't it? That balance between tight control and fostering innovation. This document, in its operational detail, really brings that tension sharply into focus.
That's a question that definitely resonates beyond just the automotive world. That balance is key everywhere.
Indeed. It's a challenge faced in any industry where complex products and vast supply chains intersect with high stakes and the need for constant improvement.
And that's our deep dive into Ford's customer-specific requirements for IATF 16949. A lot to unpack there.
A lot indeed. Thank you for joining us.